session number 20145, Reel 3.
Don Redman, Reel 3.
And Lieutenant Berger, the navigator, he also caught the blast of that very same shell, and he had most of his garments blown from him. He was wounded, but not seriously, but his clothing was blown off of him, and his underpants were in shreds, and it was an amazing scene, I'm told. The Chinese pilot, who was just stood behind me, 2 feet behind me, had the back of his head blown off. And we were all splattered on the deck when the Jimmy the One, Lieutenant Weston, who himself by this time had been injured, came up on the bridge to seek out the captain to get further orders, etc. Because the ship's helm was jammed, and we were heading towards a mud bank, and everyone was wondering why the order full speed astern had not been given. But the reason was the telegraphs were all jammed and out of order, and the helm, which is in the chart house below the bridge, was stuck, and the ship was just headed for the mud bank, which it eventually did stick right on the mud. And the engines were then stopped. And then the firing continued. And the only funny thing that ever came out of that, because it was so sad and serious, was that years later, at a reunion at the Amethyst Association in London, Jimmy the One came up to me and said, "Something, something, hell, Redman. I thought you were dead." He said, "I remember on that fateful day coming on the bridge, picking you up off the skipper, looking at you and said, 'Oh, he's a goner,' and throwing you down on the deck." I said, "Thank you very much, sir." And he promptly said, "No problem," and trotted off towards the bar for another brandy at the reunion. But apparently what happened was that he had come up on the bridge. He was also very badly wounded. Throw me off the skipper, found the skipper, who was just, well, moments away from dying. And he said to Weston, "Take command," which the Jimmy did take command, even though he was badly wounded. The next thing I remember was coming back to consciousness and seeing the carnage on the bridge, and there was the pilot with half his head blown off, and arms and bits of body hanging around, and blood everywhere. And I was helped from the bridge by someone, which I do not know who, because I was in a state of shock, obviously, down under. And I had large lumps of shrapnel sticking out of me, and I was patched up by a shipmate, because the sick berth attendant, who had been patching people up, had just been killed. And after they did a few temporary repairs on me, I was able to stand up and shaking my head, trying to get the head clear. And I was bleeding, still bleeding rather badly, and I thought, well, I could think enough to think that if I don't get this stopped, I'm going to bleed to death. So someone said, "What we need is a doctor down here. There are more people down here, you know, badly wounded than anywhere else at the moment." It was one of the lower mess decks, I think. So I said, "I'll go and try and find him for you." They said, "Will you?" And I volunteered, which has not been recorded, to go and try and find a doctor and tell him what was happening, where all the wounded were. And I got on top of the deck, and the firing was still going on, and there were bits of ping, bang, ping, and shrapnel going around, and I thought, well, this is a silly thing to have volunteered for. And I ran along the deck and found the doctor, who was obviously very, very dead. His body was in a terrible state, and he was lying dead on the upper deck. So I automatically turned around and go back to where I've come from. And as I was passing the galley, I was shot in the elbow by a bullet. And I went a little bit further, and I was hit again with another bit of shrapnel. And the first thing I said when I got back on the mess deck was, "The doctor's dead, and if you don't mind, I won't go up there again just now." And it drew a little smile from a couple of my mates. I was then helped down onto the deck, leaning against the bulkhead, and they drew a shipmate towards me, who was obviously in a very poor state. His tummy had been ripped open, and laying on his back, they let him prompt him up against me, and I put my arm around him, and with my good hand, someone pulled his stomach together, and I held it together with that hand until he died in my arms. And then after about half an hour he died, and they pulled him away from me then, and he was wrapped in a hammock, a loose hammock. And then the firing continued, and then consort arrived from Nanking. They heard we were in trouble, and there was a slight lull before consort arrived, but as soon as she arrived on the scene to help us, all hell broke loose again, and they started firing again. Well, they made three brave attempts, and it's one of the bravest things, I think, that I saw in the Yangtze River. Lots of our lads were brave, but the consort passed us by then after one attempt to rescue us. By this time, there were several killed on board her, and I realized that my lifelong friend John Bartlett was on board the consort, and I was worried for him and other Bridgewater people. So she went about again and came back to the scene to try once more to help us, and once again the firing started again, and she sustained several more hits as she passed, which meant she had to turn once more then to pass us to go. But she made one final attempt, which was three attempts under heavy fire from in a very narrow river with all the Chinese artillery firing at her, and then she finally signaled to us, "Sorry, can't help. Best of luck," or something like that, and steamed off towards Shanghai. After a while, there was another lull, and people like myself who were still bleeding, and by this time I thought, well, there can't be a lot more left. I was ordered to get into a boat to go ashore with several other, or helped to go ashore by several other shipmates who were going to row us across to the friendly bank, which was held by the nationalist soldiers, because the actual crossing of the river by the communists had not taken place yet. So you had the communists on the starboard side and the Chiang Kai-shek's army, the nationalists on the right, on the port side. So we were lowered in a boat, and as they were rowing us across to see if we could get some medical attention, because we had no one left on board who even knew how to administer morphia even. All the medical staff were killed. And at this time, they were signalling to Hong Kong, to the RAF, to see if they had an RAF doctor they could fly in the Sunderland aircraft, which they kept in Hong Kong. But we arrived on the other bank, and I was dragged up, and with about 15 others and some on stretchers. And there were still shells in. You could hear the whine of shells going overhead. And we went inland about 100 yards, and I was at the front then, struggling along with a mate, when we were stopped by a young Chinese officer who was supposed to be the friendly army, the nationalists. He was accompanied by about 8 Chinese soldiers with fixed bayonets, and this young officer most probably thought we were mercenaries or something, because out comes his revolver, and he thrusts this revolver rather painfully in my face that was already swollen, demanding and shouting and screaming, and I beckoned towards the shed, a hut that was nearby, as though I was writing, and he kind of gave me a bit of a push, and I went in there, and he produced a Chinese brush pen. And although I painted the ship many times since, this was the first time I painted the outline of a ship with a Union Jack on the back. And then with the wet brush, I went plop, 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 as I like to imitate the shell burst. And he suddenly, with that usual Chinese expression, he said, "Ah!" And he realized then what I was trying to say, that we were British. And he produced a plate of rice biscuits, which everyone, well, took one. Most of the boys took one that could, but really didn't feel like all we needed was a doctor. And I was, then I drew a cross, like a doctor, you know, Red Cross or something, you know. And he got the gist of it, that we needed a doctor, and he started giving a few orders. And we were marched then about a mile, or, and I only had one shoe on at the time, and a barefoot, marching for about a mile, when we received a bit of first aid, and they were able to stop the bleeding in my arm. And I was quite happy about that, and to lay in the grass where we were. In the meantime, they had dispatched the Sandolin aircraft from Hong Kong, made a couple of passes, and every time they did, they found it was so difficult, because, as you may know, the Sandolin aircraft is rather a large thing, and it was a narrow river, and there was the ship on fire and smoke belching from it. And and these brave guys are now known by my shipmates that are still alive, they're known as the Crazy Gang, because I've told them I'm going shortly to one of their reunions when I've been asked to speak. And I should say, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, and Crazy Gang. And I shall explain why I'm saying that, because they were so brave. And he actually landed this huge aircraft right under the noses of the Chinese artillery. And the door opened, out popped Dr. Fernley, an RAF doctor, and jumped into a sampan. And the firing has ceased, and they were telling me that I think the reason the firing has ceased, that the Chinese gunners must have thought, who would be crazy enough to land that in front of our guns on a day like this? But they did. But then they, all of a sudden, they realized what was happening. They opened fire again, and the Sunderland had to take off. But there were several of that crew were injured, minor injuries. Bullet one had a bullet in an unmentionable spot. And I've since met some of that crew, because I was back on the bank then to see this thing land. And I think they were very, very brave, but deserved the word Crazy Gang. And I was recently made an honorary member of 88 Squadron, to which the Sunderland belonged. Well, then it was decided that things were deteriorating on board, and there was enough wounded, and someone came along and who had had some instructions from the British Embassy in Nanking that those wounded were to be mustered in a position about 12 to 15 miles from where we were. And due to bandits from the Communist Army that it had already infiltrated in small numbers, we were to walk at night. That was an absolute nightmare, because I had one shoe only, my foot was already torn, and helping others as well, we marched through the night, and had several stops because of exhaustion and pain, and eventually ended up in a rural hospital, Chinese hospital. There was just one doctor, but very, very young, and some nurses who really, I think, didn't really know how to handle the situation. And we rested there overnight. The next part is a little bit of a blur to me, because we were obviously all suffering from shock still. When we realised that someone somewhere was trying to help and organising things, otherwise we were told a train of an organised force to take us to Shanghai for us all to have proper medical care and some operations. I found out later that the person was none other than Lieutenant Commander Kearns and a Colonel Jury, his name was, had been sent by the embassy in Nanking down to organise all this. And then after they saw the worst of the wounded to safety and organised lorries to take us to a train, which I can't remember being in a lorry at all, they then went and rejoined the ship, and Lieutenant Commander Kearns took command and stayed on board the ship during the negotiations with the communists after they crossed the river, and was on board and instigated the eventual escape of the ship, which cheered everyone up immensely then, because there was no further loss of life, and we were all very relieved at that. In the meantime, we arrived, a lot of the wounded arrived in Shanghai. And I remember, I've got photographs of myself taken by someone and printed in newspapers, of myself in a dressing gown being stretchered off a ship. But I can't remember a lot about that after all these years, because I've been told we're unconscious lots of the time with shock returning, etc. But I eventually ended up in Shanghai Hospital. And I was in a huge ward, and around me was about 40 beds with a door on my port side here on the left. And we were told we were all going to be operated on and had to be patient until we were thing. And I thought, well, if they start this side of the door, I should be the second in. But if they go around the other way, must probably midnight before I get my operation anyway. It was the other way around, and it was about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I was wheeled out, and I went to the operating theatre. And I was operated on by Dr. Wedderburn, who was a Scot, but he was a missionary. And I was placed on the operating table very delicately, and then I was asked to jump off the operating table and come across the room and put my arm over a very bright light which showed up where bits of shrapnel were in your arm, and asked to jump back on the operating table again. Thought this is rather funny. But anyway, they obviously operated on me, and I was wheeled back into the ward.
This is your right arm, we should say.
The right arm, yeah.
What exactly was wrong with it?
Well, I had one huge lump of shrapnel right between the two bones that had severed all the nerves and tendons. The nerves never heal, and the tendons were so badly shot up that I've never been able to open my hand since. And Dr. Wedderburn, on seeing me the following morning, said, "You'll never open your hand again, I'm afraid." But anyway, that night, when they wheeled me back into the ward after my operation, I was obviously still out with the anaesthetic. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I remember waking up, and I could feel someone catching hold of my hand. And when I looked up, it was Jean Bartlett. He was my lifelong friend who I met on the station. And he gave me a little hug and said, "I hear you're going to be all right, you know." And after a little chat, I think he reported back to his ship. And I never saw him till years later back in England when he came to visit me after he'd finished his time in the Navy. In the meantime, then, we were put aboard ships and taken to Hong Kong, where I spent about 2 months in the Peak Hospital, having further operations and antibiotics and everything, you know.
And was that operations to the same wound?
Yeah, I had 5 wounds altogether.
What were the other wounds?
Well, I had one up here into the upper chest.
On your right hand side?
Yeah, and these here, all along here.
On your right forearm?
Yeah, and the bullet went in the elbow, and there's one in the wrist, which after 50 years, you can still see it, you know, just slightly.
So it was all on the right hand side of your body?
Yeah, right hand side of my body, because the ship was facing up the river, you see, and the communists were on the starboard side, so the shell came in on the starboard and landed centre, so I caught everything down my right side. I had one small piece of shrapnel removed from my knee joint, but that would cause me very little problems. And whilst in Hong Kong, recovering, had lots of nice visitors and things. And one day I was laying on my bed, and a gentleman came in dressed in a customs officer's uniform, and tucked under his arm was a carton of 200 senior service, which he promptly threw on my chest as I was laying on my back, and with a Ronson lighter, and he said, "There are you, old sod," he said, "smoke yourself to death." I immediately recognized him as a schoolmate from Westover School in Bridgewater. And his name was John English, who was born in Hong Kong while his father was in the customs service. But they came home to Bridgewater during the war years, and he was a pupil with me in Westover School, which is just down the road. They demolished it this year, actually, the school. And he was a brilliant swimmer, I remember, at school. And he asked me after certain schoolmates and things, which I was able to help him. And when I was feeling a bit better, he came back and got permission to take me into the city for 4 or 5 days. And promised to do, you know, not to make it too exciting, and that he would report daily if I was okay, and if I needed help, he would let the hospital authorities know. So they gave him permission for me to go. And all I can say, he was staying in the Hotel Cecil in Hong Kong, central Hong Kong. And I had never had 4 or 5 days like that in my life. He ordered me to take my uniform off, which he threw on the floor. And he said, "The Chinese steward will clear this up." And he went to me, took me to his extensive wardrobe all along one wall. And I remember seeing Alan Ladd films before, where he was wearing a leather jacket. And he suited me out with kit like that, you know, and took me then the first night to Aberdeen, the floating restaurants. And he gave me a few days that I'd only imagined what it would be like years ago as a boy seaman, once I left Bridgewater and I was travelling the world. And I was actually doing things that week, which I only saw on films in the past. John always had a revolver on his inside pocket, which he zip-zip kind of thing before he went out, because in China, especially Hong Kong, being a customs officer, you're catching people, and there's a lot of bad feeling. If they get the opportunity, they pop you, as they said. So John was always armed when we went out, and he took me to some of the most fantastic places, and we only discussed it recently when he came to see me at one of my little parties I had at the British Legion. And he said, "I still got that leather jacket, you know, that you borrowed when you were there. You were so proud of it." I told him I was so proud of it. And he said, "I still got that." And he retired recently through bad health. he eventually ended up as a member of the Consort Association, because he did serve on board her for a little while after the Yangtze incident. And I've seen him several times since on his visits to Bridgewater to see his, some of his family that still live here. And during the years that have followed, we have kept in touch with everyone, you know. But on my return from the Yangtze, on our return from the Yangtze, we were honoured to be to meet the King and the Queen in Buckingham Palace, and I made a bit of a nuisance of myself while waiting for the King and the Queen to appear. I was pulling faces at Princess Margaret, for which I was promptly told off by a chief petty officer. And we had some lovely celebrations in London.
Why were you making faces at her?
Well, it was just playful gestures, you know, like, oh, look where we are. And she caught my eye first, and I looked her square in the face, and I kind of went, you know, winked and gestured, in a nice way, of course. And she smiled back, giggling, you know, and that was when I was caught. I was told off. The King eventually came along, and he was introduced to all the wounded. And I was told beforehand, do not offer your hand to the King if he goes to shake your hand, because by then I'd been fitted with a harness which was supposed to support the hand and try to get the fingers in the hand to open. It never did. But so when the King approached, I stood to attention, looking straight ahead himself. And there he was, all of a sudden, a surge of pride in me. And the King looking me square in the face, and he said, he reached forward after seeing my arms strapped up in leather and steel and things, and he caught hold of my left hand and shook hands with me. Have you finished?
Yeah, so start it again.
We're running now?
No, yes, carry on.
He shook hands with me with my left hand. He leaned forward and caught hold of my left hand and shook it, and said, sorry to see your predicament, he said. You'll soon be back on the cricket pitch, I hope. I was so thrilled, and I just, still looking straight ahead, just replied, sir. Ganges training coming out again, and you know. So, that was another happy episode in my life, and being at the palace, and then the celebrations when we met the famous windmill girls of London, Piccadilly, and various other very nice places. We had dinner, and then we returned to sanity as I arrived home once more to Bridgewater. And then after, I then had to go report back to Stonehouse Roanoke Hospital in Plymouth, where I spent 2 years. Well, they were trying to get some life back into my arms and things and my fingers. Eventually, they said, I'm sorry, this is never going to change. And I was medically discharged from the Navy.
Why do you think that the Amethyst survivors were made so much of after the incident?
Well, I think it was because Britain at the time, it was a rather dour period when rationing was still, for certain things, were still in existence, and nothing was going right for the British Empire. We were losing parts of it, and it was all bad news. And when eventually it was announced that they're now shooting up our frigates and ships up the Yangtze River, whatever next. But I think when the ship made its eventual escape, when they were told beforehand if they attempted to escape, they would be blown out of the water. But enough seemed to be enough, and things were getting very, very poor on board ship. And the old British spirit has said, try this one on for size. And they all disguised the ship, and one dark night slipped